and welcome to History on the Dark Side. For those of you who have actually stuck around since season two, thanks for the long wait. You're welcome. You might remember my son, Jacob. Hey, Jacob.
Hey.
So through a little bit of maneuvering, Jacob is back for maybe for the long haul. So instead of doing this show via 400 different filters and add-ons and softwares, he's just right here.
It's way easier.
That's him.
That's me.
So this year, we're going to just kind of talk about a bunch of different stuff. But I wanted to begin. We've got a little new studio set up here. If you see the flash and flag behind me there, that's actually some polished stainless steel that's been powder coated by my dear friend Ty Gasson at All American Metal Art. He's outstanding. I was going to the East Idaho State Fair. Because in Idaho, the East is different. So we have to have our own state fair so we're not accused of being those Boise people. Apparently it's a problem. So I walk in there with Jax, and we're just going around. We're there like any normal good American Idaho citizen to buy a switchblade, mm-hmm. which is easy to find, no problem. And as we're getting ready to walk out, there I see it. I see the spot where Ty is. I mean, he's not there, but his minion is there. You know, his buddy or his friend who's out there at the fair with him. And he's got all of these, like, military-style things and flags. They're all made out of metal, and they're awesome. And as soon as I see it, and I see it before Jack does, I just go, oh, crap. And he's like, what? What? And I was like, this next stop's about to cost me a whole bunch of money. I was not wrong. However, I am happy to say that after some pretty artful negotiation, I was able to talk my friend Ty down like $4. And I just love this flag. So new addition to the podcast, really made me happy. My first thought was to take it to school, but I work at a middle school. And that seems like the worst idea ever for anything important to you.
Yeah, kids destroy everything.
Pretty much everything. So instead it's here, where if it gets destroyed, it's my own fault. If you would like some outstanding metalwork done, Ty's website is allamericanmetalart.com. And primarily, if you're a veteran, he's a veteran. He hires veterans to work with him. He does really great work. So if you've been in the service, or you've been a policeman or a fireman or something like that, he has some outstanding stuff that you can just see the quality in. So I recommend him. I told him I'd give him a plug. Actually, I didn't. I just gave him a plug anyway because I love that thing.
Nice.
All right. Today, we're going to start off by talking about the Texas Tower Sniper, Charles Whitman, who's, I don't know, sort of the original dirtbag.
Yeah.
When I was a kid in the dark ages, so I went to school, you know, grade school, as in the late 70s and early 80s. And then later in high school, it's still late 80s. So, you know, the idea of shootings and all that, that was like gang related. This was L.A. Crips and Bloods kind of stuff. That's what I grew up with. And that was not very prevalent in a scenic Sacramento, California. Mm-hmm. There's gangs and lots of wannabes and everybody like our school colors. You went there, right? Yeah. So me and Jake went to the same high school for a couple years. Different times, different decades.
we actually had the same teachers, though.
We both had co-chairs, so that's pretty intense. So the school colors, if you remember.
Or red and blue.
Red and blue, yeah. And so at the height of the Crips and the Bloods and the gang in California era, we were not allowed to wear red or blue to our school unless you were on a sports team, because then the uniforms were red, white, and blue. So, you know, you couldn't have America, you couldn't have school colors because some people 800 miles away were shooting at each other. So there you go. Good yeah. times.
You know, it's how public school works.
What was the idea of school shootings or mass shootings like for you? Because you went to school.
Well, I went to school post-Columbine. And So, like, when I had originally heard of school shootings, that's the one that I always heard of.
Yeah.
And when I was going through school, it wasn't an elementary school. We just had, like, regular fire drills. But we did have drills of, like, somebody was on campus who wasn't supposed to be there, and we had kind of a lockdown drill. Okay. By the time I got to high school, lockdown drills were a regular occurrence, and mm-hmm. we never had anything happen at the high school I went to, but we were all very educated on, hey, this happens a lot in America.
Right.
So I was definitely familiar with lockdown procedures, and, like, we knew that there were school shooters, and that was a real concern.
And I think for probably most of our listening audience, Columbine's it. That's the seminal moment where life changed. And I would even agree with that. I remember a little bit about the shooting in Texas, not because I was there. I'm not that old. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was the joke. Before people went postal, you talked about, oh, I'm going to go up the bell tower. I'm going to go up the clock tower. So that became kind of a cultural thing for, you know, just a saying that people understood, oh, I'm really frustrated and feel like doing bad things. And people said that in jest, like, oh, I'm just going to climb the bell tower. We did not really expect that anyone was actually going to climb the bell tower. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, nowadays people do.
You know, I mean, it's even worse on the school shooting side when I want to say it was like last year or the year before or something. There were more school shootings in the U.S. than weeks in the year.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And when, you know, kind of what we'll get into today is that it all maybe have started here with Charles Whitman.
Yeah.
And one of the big, I don't know if it's right to say it's one of the big causes, but one of the big factors in that is media coverage.
Because yes.
This, like, there had been domestic terrorist attacks in the U.S. before
mm-hmm.
this happened, but this one got so much coverage,
yeah.
so much media presence that it gave others a blueprint for, oh, I want my 5 minutes of fame. Here's
yeah.
how I can get it.
And a lot of that's technologically based. I mean, you had the Haymarket riots back in, you know, just before 1900.
Yep.
Nobody knew that was coming, but in today's world, there would have been news people there, not just reporters, but cameramen and all that.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a guy who went on a spree shooting in, I think it was New Jersey, several years before Charles Whitman did this. But again, it wasn't, you know, it was over in a day, and it wasn't like there's any cameras involved in that situation. It was print media.
Mm-hmm.
So aside from everything else that happens with Whitman, you've got live, real-time coverage of this thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very accessible today,
yep.
that same coverage. All of it's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll put up some of those links and sources and all those things kind of at the end. It's interesting to talk about this stuff because there's a lot of podcasts that just go through it bit by bit by bit and kind of give you the extended timeline. And there's a lot of true crime podcasts, I think, that kind of delve into this stuff, but don't look at it as anything but like an amateur kind of way. So
yeah.
I'm not trying to say that I am the end all do all of research or whatever. I am a historian. You know, I have a degree in history. I teach history in a middle school. I also am teaching in college. I'm a professor. So I try and bring a little bit of that to the subject, but it's a very cultural thing.
Yeah.
It's a thing that's hard to get around because it does seem like it's, well, it doesn't seem like it's getting worse. It's worse.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to go
undeniable.
To the beginning here and if you want to, like, get the bullet points and the dates of when stuff happened, we're not your show.
Yeah.
Right?
We're not here to do the play-by-play. Kind of on the true crime point that you were making, whenever I think about what this podcast is and what kind of content that we are going to convey, we have some overlap with topics that a lot of true crime podcasts might have, but we are not attacking these conversations with that approach in mind.
No, not at all.
That's boring. I can't read numbers right, so I will mix them all up. I'm only human. I live with that. It happens. But, you know, what we're here to do is to kind of take a look at everything and really just have a discussion on what happened then, how does it relate to now, and what all has changed in between.
Now, what hasn't? What hasn't changed?
I feel like there's going to be a long list on that point.
So just statistically, Whitman is the first mass shooter to use a rifle. That's, I guess, in America, that's his claim to fame. Because the people before then who just went crazy, and that's even wrong to call it crazy, the people before that who just decided they were going to do that, because ultimately that's what we're talking about is some decisions here.
Yeah.
Generally it was handguns, but he's the first guy to take a rifle somewhere and mass shoot with that. And that's still not the norm. It gets most of the coverage because the guns are scary and you can do a lot of damage very quickly with a modern sporting rifle. Yep. The most common mass shootings are still handguns. Three guesses as to why that would be.
Easily accessible, easy to conceal.
There you go. If I'm walking down the street with an AR, it's pretty noticeable. Yep. Now, here in Idaho, this might not even raise an eyebrow. Mm-hmm. This is one of those states where you can legitimately walk down the street with the AR slung over your shoulder. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, especially out here on the east side, they wouldn't even bat an eye. And growing up in California, that was not a thing.
Yeah.
That's a different mindset. I'm not here to say it's right or wrong. I don't know if it makes me feel more or less comfortable to think that some of my friends and neighbors are doing such things, but it's just different. So what are some of the things about Charles's background that just kind of jumped out at you?
Well, when you're looking at it from a shooter perspective, he's got the military background, so he has military training. The guy knows what he's doing. But even before that, he had, you know, his dad took him and his brothers out to shoot. And so they knew how to shoot. They were good at it. He did a lot of deer hunting and stuff. And then when he goes into the military to take his sniper test, he doesn't even get the rank of sniper. He gets sharpshooter.
Yeah.
Which I believe is one underneath that.
Yeah, yeah. The best is expert. Mm-hmm. And he did not... And I got to think he's ticked, right? He must be just like, what the crap?
It has to be.
Because it sounds like he's already kind of got a reputation as being a very good shooter.
Mm-hmm.
His dad, who's much maligned, seems like for good reason.
Yeah.
He said that at 16 he could, I believe his words were, plug the eye out of a squirrel.
Yep.
So that's impressive.
Mm-hmm. And. Another thing that really stands out about his background is that relationship that he has with his dad. For what seems like his entire childhood, his dad held him to the standard that he needed to be perfect. And that really, really comes out in a myriad of different ways throughout Charles's life. Whenever he's doing poorly in school, if things aren't going well socially, it really, really weighs on him.
Right.
And despite him only having like a 2.0 GPA throughout school, everybody thought of him as the golden boy. He was really, really charismatic. Everybody liked him and everybody thought he was a straight A student because he had built up this image for himself in what seems to be a way to protect himself from not being perfect or admitting that he isn't perfect.
And one of those things that I wonder about as a parent, you know, he gets tested. I don't know why. Okay. I don't know why this happens. So he gets tested at 6 years old and has a 139 IQ. So that's very high, mm-hmm. super smart. However, I have often thought me as a middle-aged man, I have no idea what my IQ is. I feel comfortable it's not 139.
Yeah.
Dang smarter than any sixth grader in any way. Like, it's just not a thing. So, you know, if that idea of an IQ test is reveals how much capacity you have mm-hmm. to gain knowledge, to gain wisdom, then I guess that number matters.
Yeah.
But when the rubber hits the road, I mean, how much of it do you ever actually develop probably matters a great deal more than the raw number, I would think.
Yeah. It's another interesting thought, just talking about the IQ test. If I take an IQ test at 6 years old and I get a 139, that's it. I'm a genius, and I'm going to wear that badge for the rest of my life. I'm never going to take another IQ test.
Right, right. There's no retest.
I don't know how much that number changes throughout a person's life, but if I ever get a high enough score, that's it. And from that point on, I'm going to be a little bit smug about it.
So it'd be interesting to know, and I didn't find this out in the research, whether that was a thing where mom and dad wanted to test Charles, mm-hmm. whether the school tested him. Maybe in that era, that was just a thing that happened.
Yeah.
IQ tests are relatively newer then than now. Mm-hmm. So maybe that was just part of that early idea of identifying and tracking people. You know, you got your low kids and they're going to go to this completely other school. We're going to, you know, gifted track these nerds. That's something that's kind of starting to develop then, where you're breaking up the kids into different categories and trying to keep them, you know, it's like a mental segregation, really.
That yeah, it could we're, definitely be seen like that.
We're just getting away from racial segregation and go, you know what? Let's do it mentally.
Well, even when I was in like fifth and sixth grade, they had like the GATE program.
Right.
And, you know, it's where the stigma within, you know, the students was that the GATE program is where all the super smart kids go. It's for all the straight A kids. And I don't know what they did there, but I know one day they built a catapult. And they were shooting off like water balloons at the school through this catapult. It was awesome. So I remember wanting to get into the GATE program. And I think that I had gone to my teacher. I went to mom or something. And I was like, hey, what's up with this? I want in. And they were like, oh, well, your grades aren't good enough. If you get better grades, we'll let you in. And I was like, cool. That sounds like effort. And I didn't want it.
I was in the GATE program mm-hmm. when it was new. And we actually, they shipped us to a different school, and they sent us to a school, and this is very interesting to me in retrospect, which is where kids who were developmentally disabled went. Mm-hmm. So they had all these kids with every kind of physical or mental disability you could think of, mm-hmm. and then a classroom that we'd get bused to once or twice a week mm-hmm. for all of us alleged nerd kids. One of the really good things about that was I interacted with these kids. That was part of the program. Like, yeah. we developed an awareness, and it wasn't like a, oh, we're so smart and you're so not. It was not that at all.
Yeah.
So I really feel like having that kind of a program and that kind of an environment made it less judgy, I guess, less yeah. where you start to self-idealize that you're something you're not.
Yeah.
For the record, you know, your aunt, my sister, she's got cerebral palsy. So I grew up around that as well. And that, no doubt that had part to do with that.
Yeah.
So he's a really smart kid. How does that affect dad? I mean, no. I'm going to guess dad always wanted his kids to do his best, but we don't hear. It's funny, like there's not a lot of record about the brothers. So not Charles right. has a couple brothers. He's the oldest.
Yep.
They both die pretty tragically. We can get to that more at the end if you want. But like one dies of complications from AIDS. One dies at a bar or something in a, mm-hmm. by gunfire.
Yep.
Crazy. So I'm going to guess daddy wanted this level of, you know, had this expectation of perfection for all of them. Mm-hmm. And being an oldest son, you're an oldest son.
Yep.
Like, that's a whole nother burden to carry, too.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Especially if you're in a traditional family in the 1960s, that's nuclear family as you can get.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you're the firstborn, you've got to not only be you, but you've got to set this bar for everybody.
Well, and when dad is already so beyond, like, his expectations are so high in, hey, you need to be perfect, and the first son is a genius at 6 years old, and, you know, kind of check marks off all these other boxes, then it puts a big standard, or casts a long shadow on the younger siblings.
Yeah.
Because one day, that older brother is going to move out, and all of a sudden, all of dad's attention is on the next one.
Right, right. And you see that all the time in cases of abuse or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. there's usually one kid who catches it the worst.
Yep.
Even if it's kind of the way the parent or whoever is.
And if they get out, that attention just goes somewhere else.
Right. So maybe the benefit to Charles, and this is horrible, it's not a benefit, but that attention isn't just on him because, mm-hmm. you know, his dad beats his mom. He's abusive to her.
Yep.
So I guess he doesn't have to catch all of it, but I got the sense that as he got older, he felt a very real need mm-hmm. to try and save mom, to try and protect yep. mom.
And he absolutely adored his mom. And that really, really comes across throughout his life. By the end of his life, he had, you know, convinced his mom to leave his dad, and she moved out to Texas with him, and he put her up in an apartment, and mm-hmm. he went to make sure that she was doing okay at work. He was taking care of her while also having a family on his own.
And I think it's interesting you say that, because you see this a lot with when you have parents that suffer from addiction, mm-hmm. a lot of times you will have the kids that are acting in the role as a parent.
Yeah.
Because somebody's got to do this. Mm-hmm. And so one of the kids might take care of the brothers and sisters, but they're often raising or taking care of the parent as well. Mm-hmm. And that's not great.
Yeah.
Like, when that breaks down, that's not how things are supposed to work. And somebody needs to take care of things, so that's good.
Yeah.
But it messes up your head when you're a kid and you know you're supposed to be receiving safety and love and support and all these things, and you're not, but you're required, or at least you feel required to give it, mm-hmm. that can be really hard.
Yep.
And it struck me that he's really overboard about this. Like, something that really just stood out to me, there's a point when mom moves out, and he is so worried that dad's going to kill her for moving out, mm-hmm. that he calls the local sheriff to go and just watch the house while she packs up and leaves. Mm-hmm. Interesting to me because he didn't go do that himself. So I don't know if that means mom decided she's leaving just all of a sudden. Maybe because she's in Florida at the time. He's in Texas. So there's a disconnect there. But that's a day or two. Mm-hmm. I sure get the sense that, you know, if he wanted to be there to help out his mom, he's going to drop everything and go do that. I can't remember if he's in the Corps at the time or not. So if you're in the Corps, you can't just leave.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to remember. For most of his adult life, he was really, really struggling with schoolwork and maintaining his GPA just so that way he didn't get kicked out of school.
Right.
Or dealing with military stuff. He had enlisted in the military twice. And the first time he went, it was everything that his dad would have loved. He did a really good job. He got high praise. And the second time he went, it was the opposite. He had a lot of trouble with gambling. He didn't fit in the same way that he felt before. At this point, he was married, and he had really, really missed his wife.
He missed his wife. He missed being in school.
Yep. And I believe that this time, things were escalating back at home between his dad and his brothers. And so he felt this crushing weight on top of his shoulders.
Right.
On top of everything else.
Because one of the brothers moves out with mom.
Yep.
And the other brother stays out there and is actually working for dad. So you've got a real divide there.
Yep.
There's part of me that in reading his story and thinking about this, I don't think he would have gone out there to physically help his mom, even if he could. I think he's scared of his dad.
It seems that way. because he goes to great lengths to keep his mom separated from his dad.
Right. But it's never with him personally. Like, he wants nothing to do with that face-to-face encounter.
Yeah.
And, man, you know, like, when I was growing up, when I got in high school, I, like many 16, 17-year-old boys, was positive that I was bulletproof and I was some sort of demigod or something. No one could beat me at anything, and I knew everything. So yeah. I think this is common. I did not fear my father at that point. Now, later on, when I look back at some of the stupid stuff I ever said or did, I'm like, oh, crap, my dad really could have, he could have hurt me bad in this instance.
Yep.
And he showed all this restraint not to, and I was just too full of myself to see it back then.
Well, and that might be part of the big difference here, is that even though Whitman's dad was beating his mom, he still got some of the beatings too.
Right.
And so I doubt that he ever had a point where he felt like he was invincible. He always knew that he could get bruised.
Yeah.
That he could get beat up. There's a story about how one day he goes out at night and he goes driving the car off somewhere. He went to some party. He got super, super drunk. He comes home at night.
It was just before graduation.
Yeah, just before graduation. And his dad catches him and beats the tar out of him, like pushes him in the pool.
Yeah.
And Whitman almost drowns and dies that night. Somehow, he had drug himself out of the pool and passed out on the concrete next to the pool. And
right.
That's where he woke up the next day.
And what I really wonder at this point is, like, I don't have any doubt that dad threw the guy in the pool.
Yeah.
Right?
No doubt.
But I'm sure he laid into him. He probably put some hands on him.
Yep.
Did he actually almost drown him, or is that just how he, and, you know, that's what it felt like to him? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to try and guess, but yeah, that could go either way.
That part of the story is a little bit fuzzy.
Because dad's not talking about nothing.
There's no helping him out of the pool.
Yeah. Right?
That's for sure.
I'm done here. I'm going in the house. Yeah, crazy, crazy stuff. And
it's crazy to me to think about that because, you know, your dad and you want all your kids and your family to be perfect. And this is your golden child.
Right.
And if he winds up dead in the swimming pool tonight, that's going to bring down your entire perfect family. Like, well, there's going to be people coming around. There's going to be people looking into the family. That's a huge, huge thing. But apparently at the time, dad didn't care at all.
Or maybe that's one of those moments where you've taught a lesson. You've taught your child that sometimes it's better that someone dies than has to live with the shame. Like, I'm your mean old dad and I'd rather you die and live with that than live with the shame of you're this goofy, coming home drunk, can't get it together guy. Like, I mean, that's a crappy lesson to teach.
Yeah, that's a pretty, pretty lame lesson to teach.
And as as I was reading about Whitman's background, David Pelzer kept coming to my mind. Pelzer, he wrote a couple books. The most famous one is A Child Called It. Mm-hmm. Or is it A Boy Called It?
That's A Child.
A Child Called It. And he's super abused by his mother, and it's worse, okay?
Far worse.
It's worse because it's sustained, and she's actively turning the rest of the family against him, and he has to steal food at school just to eat, or he'll starve to death. Like, this is sustained, just evil abuse. Mm-hmm. And as an adult, and as he got older, as an older teenager, when he's trying to sort this out, and he's going through foster care and all this, he's got this point, right? Like, if you're abused, there's a point where, am I going to be part of this cycle of abuse? Mm-hmm. Am I going to continue that? Am I going to do something else with it? Mm-hmm. And I think that strikes me so much that because, you know, when we see these school shooters, everybody's like, oh, I bet his parents were terrible. Mm-hmm. And, oh, he's probably bullied. Maybe, but lots of people are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lots of people are. I had good parents. I can't say anything bad about them.
I do too.
Well, yeah. You know, I was going to make a dead mom joke there, but I'm going to fight the urge.
I was thinking of it too. We'll save it for later in the season.
But, you know, I was bullied by neighborhood kids. I was bigger for my age, so I hung out with kids that were older, which meant they were faster and smarter and all that stuff. I got bullied quite a bit until one day, now I was bigger and now I'm smart too. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I'm not getting bullied anymore. And I wasn't.
Yeah.
But... Well, that's not up to me, right? Like, I happened.
That's another part of, like, the school-going experience. You will never find anybody who went through public school and didn't get bullied, period.
Yeah.
It happens to everybody. And so whenever, like, you know, there's definitely some more severe bullying than getting picked on in class because some kid wants the answers to your test. And there's way, way worse things that could happen. And so whenever somebody talks about, like, oh, I bet their parents were bad and they got bullied. Well, it's like, okay, everybody got bullied.
Right.
What type of bullying are we talking about?
Right.
Because there, you know, there's bullying and there's traumatic type of things. And I'm not for either. But in the real world, everybody gets bullied.
So our Whitman, he's like the youngest Boy Scout in America, allegedly. He got his Eagle Scout. I guess he's the youngest Eagle Scout. About as quick as you can do it, because there's time connected to these things. And it might have been different in the 60s, but he does that. He goes on to be a scout leader as well when he's older.
Yep.
And in some interviews, I heard one guy that was just like, oh, you know, it was kind of fun because he was a great shot and he'd take us shooting and we like that. It's my experience as a scout leader that boys like to do stuff like that.
And the scout, being a scout leader thing, this all ties into he has to have this perfect image built around him.
Right.
He's, because at the time he didn't have kids, he's just helping out with the troop. He had gone out and done the Boy Scouting, and it seems like something that he would have absolutely loved, being in the outdoors, having the opportunity to shoot and stuff. And so being able to give back to the community in something that he's actually good at, that's something that he would definitely pick up in order to help bolster his personal...
Yeah, his self-image or whatever.
Yep.
But some of these kids talk about how he would do goofy stuff like throw a dollar bill on the ground and do handstand push-ups. And be like, if you can do whatever, 1, 10, however many of these, then I'll give you that dollar. Well, these are, you know, 12, 13-year-old kids. They can't do it. And so then he would, like, snatch up the dollar and laugh at them. Like, there's this weird low-level sadisticness that's apparent, but it's in that whole gray area of, like, is that... I mean, he seems like a nice guy, but he does
kind of
odd things.
Yeah.
So there's that going on, too. When he is in the military the first time, he helps a guy who, like, crashes a Jeep or whatever. Yep. He, like, lifts the Jeep.
And
saves this guy basically by himself. So, again, there's a point where he's not constantly what we would call evil, right?
No.
He's certainly not constantly good. He's not constantly trying to... And even some of the things that are good, why is he doing them? You know, why does he protect mom the way he does? Is it because he's concerned for her safety and he loves and wants to protect her? Or does he have this misguided relationship reversal and it's chewing him up? There is a lot going on with this guy.
Because that relationship that he has with his mom, where he's trying to take care of her, does not translate to his brothers. He cares about his brothers. He wants what's best for them, but he's never gone out of his way to protect them from dad.
Right.
So.
Interesting. And, you know, if you are not familiar with this story, mommy's the first person he kills.
Yep.
So it's not like it's all unicorns and flowers or something. This is rainbows. That's what I was looking for. I forgot the word rainbow. You know, as you get older, sometimes you forget things. There are other problems. We'll save those for another show.
We'll have a whole episode, the 50 things that we get worse as you get older.
Let's just never have that
Number
episode.
One, you forget rainbows.
What? So when it really starts to go bad, there's some key things that seem different. There seems to be some escalation of the violent or aggressive tendencies. Mm-hmm. So when he's back in the military, he's gambling, but he's also loan sharking.
Yep.
And what he gets busted for is he's shaking down somebody who borrowed 30 bucks, it seems like, related to this gambling. And then he wanted him to pay back the 30 plus 15. So that's a pretty high VIG.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he went full on New Jersey style on that. And, you know, he's going to come to blows with another Marine over this. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're in the military, you would think you're going to maybe be a little more aggressive anyway. And the Marine Corps certainly has that they're perceived mm-hmm. as being maybe the most aggressive. But it's also, you can't mess around with other people yep. and because they're going to tell your sergeant and you're screwed.
Yep.
Like, however you're going to be, you have to take care of your brothers mm-hmm. because you will get in trouble. And he sure did.
Yep.
He got popped 2 ranks for that, which, you know, I think you spend some time in the brig, you get dropped down a rank. It seems like if you're going to get popped down 2 ranks, that's
a big deal.
We're going somewhere now.
Yep. And we're going down fast.
And at the high point, when he went to school the first time, it was part of a scholarship program that mm-hmm. the military's paying him to go, because if he gets this degree in engineering, they're going to make him an officer when he comes out.
Yeah.
And then that's got to be what he wants. So now you went from potential officer to busted back down to private. Mm-hmm. It's all bad.
And that first time that he's going to school for architecture, he's going to school, and that's the time that he meets the woman that's going to be his wife.
Yeah.
I forget her name.
Kathy. Kathleen, but he calls her Kathy.
So they, you know, he seems like he was a very social guy. He was really good at dating. And so it seems like he had been going around dating, you know, a bunch of different girls, and he found Kathy and he really, really liked her. And it was shortly after they had met that they got married. And then by the time that things start going south in school and he's at risk of losing his scholarship and in turn his officer position, that's when he decides to re-enlist in the military.
Well, it wasn't even re-enlistment. When he lost the scholarship, he was, quote, out. He wasn't really ever out. He's in the military, but he's allowed to go to school because they want him mm-hmm. when he's done with school.
Got it.
So as soon as they pull the scholarship or whatever you want to call it, he's back. He's back active duty.
Yep.
It's probably no accident. But this is all Cuban Missile Crisis time, too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it could be that his grades, while they were very mediocre, might have been enough if we weren't paranoid that there might be World War III any minute.
Yeah.
So that could have conspired against him. And I got to think that in his brain, that's the kind of stuff he's looking at. Like who is wronging me?
Yeah.
I'm reading a book right now. It's called A Taller Tower. I'll look up who it's by at the end. And, you know, they talk a lot about how almost all of these shooters share this feeling of being victimized, mm-hmm. victimized. And Whitman's, you know, victimized by dad, mm-hmm. victimized by the Corps, victimized by the school.
Yeah.
Like when he's got these bad grades, he's going to like try and talk his professors into giving him higher grades. Like, dude, you didn't earn it.
Nope.
You're not going to talk your way into an A. But that's the kind of ballsy, like self-centered, narcissistic thing. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I'll just go talk my way into better grades.
Yeah.
Like there's a confidence. Like he moved here and within 24 hours he had like 2 jobs. Yeah. I was like, what the crap, dude?
It was actually one of my most impressive feats I've ever done. it was tight.
He goes in and he interviews with a lot of confidence. But I'm pretty sure if you walk into those places and you're just like, look, you want to hire me because I'm a lot better at this job than you are. And, okay, you don't get hired for that.
It doesn't work like that.
So And I get the feeling that narcissistic people often feel like they project confidence. Mm-hmm. And they just don't.
It's one of those skewed things where everything they say sounds confident, but it's like a little pretentious.
Yeah.
And that doesn't go well with people.
And people can tell, except all kind of mental illness, the person who's got it is the last to know.
Yep, the last one to find out.
Okay, so he's going through all this, and he starts having some physical symptoms.
We forgot one super important thing.
Okay.
While he's there at school, he's doing the architecture program.
Yeah.
And he sees the tower. And
he sees the clock tower. You can't not see it. It's the second tallest building in Texas at the time.
It's huge. It's huge. It's right there in the middle. It's got broad open sides on every angle. And it's a beautiful building. And he remarks on the beauty of the architecture. And he makes a special point of noting that it looks like a fortress. And one man could hold his own up there for as long as he needed.
Yep. Yeah, I think I got part of the quote here. He said allegedly he told this to another student. This part doesn't come out until after all this happens, of course. But he said, you could stand off an army from the clock tower.
Yep.
So this is 4 years before he does just that, or he tries to.
Yep.
So there's that kind of foreshadowing that often accompanies these things.
And we were talking before about he's kind of good and he's kind of bad and he's always not quite, you know, full good or full evil.
Yeah.
But it just shows that things like this are always in his mind.
Yeah.
He's always looking at things and thinking, how can I protect this? What can I do with this? How can I turn this into my advantage or into a weapon?
Right. There's this whole thing at the end that, this is maybe just a physical thing because he had a little brain tumor in a particular spot. Okay, you know, the pathology, and I'm not a doctor. I'm a historian. The pathology of even that kind of cancer in that exact place is not that you start thinking these kind of thoughts 4 years earlier.
No.
That's not a thing.
And that's something that we're really going to be able to get into after the fact.
Right.
But it is further foreshadowing of what is to come.
And lots and lots of people who go on to commit these kinds of atrocities foreshadow. And there's not a big difference between someone who does a mass shooting, a spree shooting, or commits suicide. In the realm of those three seemingly different things, mm-hmm. it's very, very common, and the term now is called leakage, that there's leakage of the plan. Their ideas get out. They tell someone, they write something down somewhere, mm-hmm. they make a paper that gets turned into school, mm-hmm. that in retrospect looks pretty obvious, yeah. but in the moment just made somebody go,
it's just like, I wonder if, because to me, this is my first time hearing the term, but it does make sense. And it sounds like these people, you know, they want to be able to justify their actions.
Yeah.
But they know that in the moment they won't have the time, they won't be able to sit someone down and talk them through everything.
Right.
And so they want to leave something behind that after all is said and done, people can look back and go, oh, I know why this happened.
Or maybe, and this doesn't have to be either or, mm-hmm. but I think in especially today's world with the internet, like back then, who is he going to talk to and tell this to and ever get any kind of a even tepid, oh yeah, uh-huh. mm-hmm. you know, like that's not going to be very common.
Yeah.
And when I see how these shootings have proliferated over the years, I think it's because right now, if I want to go online, I can find someone who agrees with anything I say.
Yeah.
Somewhere on this planet, there's somebody else who will go, dang straight, that's exactly how I feel. You're 100% right, no matter what crazy thing you say.
Yeah.
And I wonder if this idea of social interaction and having to deal with real life people over time wasn't an insulator. Mm-hmm. And more, you know, like the guy who shot up Newton, he never left his room except to go to the mall and play DDR. Like, he lived online and actively restricted real world contact. But he had online places he would go to talk about various nefarious things, because you can always find somebody.
Yeah.
I think that's been terrible for criminals, because society self-regulated. Mm-hmm. You said something or did something and people are like, even if they're not like, hey, we got to lock this guy up. They're like, hey, when so-and-so's out mowing his lawn, I don't want you playing in the front yard.
Yeah.
That's a thing. Mm-hmm. Like, were there people in the neighborhood when we were growing up at different places we lived where I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to let you go play at that kid's house.
Yeah.
It was never because of the kid. It was usually because of there's some stuff going down in that house that's not cool.
I remember, you know, growing up and, like, anytime I wanted to go to a friend's house after school, I'd have to tell my friends, I can't come over until, like, my mom and dad come meet your parents.
Right. And mom would shake you down.
Mom would shake them down, yeah.
She would go over there, full-on interview. She's doing background checks. Mom did not play around.
Mom had a real investigator nerve.
I would maybe go by and just make sure the house isn't on fire and you're not actively shooting up heroin. Like, if you manage that, I'm probably okay. But mom had a much higher standard. And that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. But I remember, because, you know, for the most part, it was never a problem. Mom would come down and, you know, it'd be like the first play date that we ever had with these people. Yep. Mom would come over and they'd sit down and talk with the parents. And to me, it didn't matter, because it was just, my mom's got to meet your parents. And then there was the one day where, you know, we're done with the play date and I go home with mom, and in the car on the ride home, mom says, you're not allowed to go to that house. They can come over to our house all they want, but you cannot go there.
And that was always the thing. They can come to us
because
we know what we're going to provide for you and this other kid. Mm-hmm. Like, and sometimes that would be the whole thing. Like, I'm not even as worried for you as I know this other kid needs a safe place to go.
Yep.
He needs a place because he's in hell. Mm-hmm. I can remember, and it's tough being a parent and seeing that, because you're like, you know, when things are bad, but they're not like, I need to call a cop, somebody has to get arrested right now, bad. It's a crappy feeling as a neighbor and a friend. You're like, oh, what do I do? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's that. Yeah. But he tells people, you know, that's allegedly 4 years beforehand.
Uh-huh.
And there's other people. Mm-hmm. Like, in today's world, it's, you know, if you see something, say something. Mm-hmm. And that has nothing to do with school shooters. That's a post 9/11 thing. Mm-hmm. It took that for America to go, whoa, sometimes stuff that looks wrong
is wrong.
And 100 years ago, people knew that naturally. And we called it common sense, and we called it intuition. And somehow we've talked ourselves out of that. Like, if somebody gives you the creeps, you should probably maybe not hang out with them.
Well, it might also just be that we've kind of gotten ourselves to the point where it's like, I'm going to mind my business, you mind your business.
Right.
And as long as your business isn't like a problem, like up in my way and affecting my life, then I'm going to stay out of it. Like, because there's like, we don't want to feel like we're nosy people.
Right.
And we don't want other people to go around saying that we're spreading gossip or anything. But especially in these like kind of small interactions in big public places, like at an airport. You know, I don't know any of the people there.
Right.
I'm not going to have any conversations with any of the people there. And so when I see something weird, normally I would just ignore it. But now we, you know, after 9/11, if anything happens in an airport, you go tell somebody.
Right. And you, and again, it comes down to that idea of security and self-segregation. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I don't mean that in any kind of like racial or mental way, but like, if you feel like somebody just as off for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Individually, then you keep you and yours away from them. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, whatever they're doing, that's over not there, the best.
It's not gonna
because
me.
If they're doing really bad things and hurting other people over there, you didn't help.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's only so much you can do to help. So I guess that's the, especially with these things, that's where do you land, you know? Yeah. But he's got other leakage. Because, okay, you know, what do we do if somebody said that at school today? Well, we'd tell the, you know, if you're in grade school, elementary school, high school, you're going to tell the school counselor.
Yep.
They're going to pull this kid in, and they're going to do some kind of threat assessment.
Yeah.
Right? Well, and that Whitman chooses to go see a psychologist and try and work through, because he's got all this stuff going on. That's not super uncommon. It's super uncommon to have somebody who ends up committing suicide or doing some of these atrocities continuously going in therapy with somebody. But it's not that uncommon that they do once or twice and then they just kind of like, oh, hey, I gave that its chance.
Yeah.
They failed me too.
Yeah.
Now I can be a victim of that whole system. So, you know, he goes to the school shrink. And says, hey, that the bell tower again, the it's not, there's no bell, the clock tower. Oh, fun fact, do you know this, so this thing's a library, right?
The clock tower?
Clock tower's a library.
That makes sense, because he was always studying there.
And when it was built, and when it was first done, this is nuts. The librarians were downstairs, you know, you would look up in the old Dewey Decimal card system.
Yeah.
Find the book you want, and you never went upstairs to get the book. They had, like, people who worked in the library on roller skates that would zip around whatever, get the book, put them on a dumbwaiter, and send them down to you.
Dang.
That can't be that efficient. But cool. But if those policies would have been in place,
yeah,
surprisingly, this probably would have never happened here. This was going to happen somewhere.
Yeah.
Because people who want to do bad things generally want to do bad things. Though there is a lot of science that suggests that those bad things are tied to specific places. Mm-hmm. Back to the, you know, the Newton shooter. One of the things that may have set off his timing to do what he did is Mom was talking about moving again. Mm-hmm. And he had already sort of idealized that this is the spot I would do this.
Yeah.
So there's some association with the proximity of an actual physical location and many of these things. And it's not particularly random.
That kind of makes sense when you think of, like, somebody is, they've decided they're going to do this heinous act because they're going to make their mark on the world.
Right.
And if they're going to have all of this value in their mind about what they're going to do, you would think that they are going to think about where they're going to do it at. They, you know, there's logistics involved.
Right.
They're going to plan it out. And it's almost like the writing's on the wall for them.
Right.
That this is where it's at. They, at that point, they probably feel like this is the only place that I can do it.
And if you've not seen, it's a little bit older documentary. It's called The Bridge. And it's about the Golden Gate Bridge. So this was, for a number of years, the number one suicide destination on Earth.
Yep.
And when they put up the nets and the barricades so you can't just jump off the bridge anymore, the number of suicides went dramatically down, which makes sense. Well, you can't jump off anymore. But the number of people who were planning to commit suicide, but once the bridge wasn't available anymore, didn't. That's a real thing. Like, once the location was taken away from them, their whole entire plan kind of fell apart, and they didn't just, oh, well, I'll just kill myself another way. You see that a lot with, like, people who, it's one of the questions. I mean, they teach us this when I'm working with the kids in school, you know. If somebody says they want to hurt themselves, that's an issue. They want to hurt themselves or others. If they have an idea of what they want to use to hurt themselves, if they have a plan or a place, that is a much bigger issue. Yeah. Because you're down this spectrum, you're down this line further.
Yeah.
So I guess another thing that's interesting to me is this idea of where's the point of departure when, okay, I have thought about this in whatever level, mm-hmm. but now I'm past that yeah. and I'm actively doing it. And I think there's several of those markers along the way. Mm-hmm. And I think one of them is that time, place, what am I going to use? For many.
What, when, where, how, why?
Yeah, yeah. When I have a legitimate plan, okay, I've moved past the planning stage. I have crossed that Rubicon. And the ability to intervene is, I mean, the time frame is going to get shorter. Mm-hmm. And effective intervention is going to become less and less likely. Like, I think all the way up until you're done with that part, mm-hmm. maybe you can actively change these people and help them and kind of steer them away from things.
Yeah.
And I feel in my very non-trained, not a counselor, not a psychiatrist mind, mm-hmm. that when you've crossed that, like if, from the public perspective, at that point, all I want to do is mitigate the damage. All I want to do now is keep you from hurting others.
Yeah.
Because you're in, and I don't think I can save you anymore.
Yeah.
I don't think it's, and you know, I'm so happy if somebody can prove me wrong and say, hey, I was already further down the road than this, and I got yeah. turned around through psychology, religion, a good friend. I don't care. That's great.
Yep.
But my gut is, and you know, my very non-official research mm-hmm. is that when you've crossed that point, you're realistically about damage control.
Yeah.
And that's not something I see teaching in a public school.
No.
Like, when a kid has something happen, and it's crazy to me that this stuff happens in junior high. Like, my mind is blown by that.
Yep.
But it does. And when kids come back into school after having said that they're having these kind of thoughts or these kind of issues, and it's already past that point where, you know, thankfully, I've not ever had a kid who came back from a legitimate suicide attempt that I know of, but I know that that's happened. I don't teach every kid in the school.
Yeah.
At that point, like, the system is not concerned. They're still trying to save this kid.
Yeah.
And their emphasis, in my opinion, is not on the rest of the school. Like, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. I think it's a societal problem too, because we get tied up in our ideas of rights and freedoms and independence, and we don't want someone locking us down for mm-hmm. a day, a week, or taking our stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I own guns. Mm-hmm. I like them.
Yeah.
They almost never come out of my safe. Mm-hmm. I have a permit to conceal carry when I don't need one in Idaho. I never do. I have never concealed carried a gun. I don't know. I'm okay with that. But even liking them and owning some, like, there's got to be some kind of way to limit people who we realize are somewhere on that spectrum. Like, mm-hmm. at some point, like, it's not worth the risk to everyone else. It's not okay.
I think that ties in really well with something that Whitman did right before going out and doing his shooting.
Thank you for listening to History on the Dark Side. Stay tuned next week for the exciting conclusion of The Tower Shooter.